Thank you very much, Abaya, for that kind introduction. Hello. This is actually the first time I've given a talk in Britain for over 10 years. And I'm very pleased, actually, I'm very pleased to be giving a talk here to you in the Cambridge Buddhist Centre. And I'm especially pleased to be giving a talk on Chatrau Sangye Dorje Rinpoche, because I think in the last 10 years, he's probably the man who's had most impact on me of everybody I've met. So I hope that I'm able to not only tell you a bit about Chatrau Rinpoche, but convey something about what he's actually like. So yes, as Abaya said, Chatrau Sangye Dorje Rinpoche is the last of Bhante's teachers to be alive. He's still alive. And the last time I met him was was just over a year ago in Nepal. I've met him on 5 occasions now. This is Chatrau Rinpoche, in case you hadn't guessed, in the shrine. And I think that this photograph was probably taken around about the time that Bhante first met Rinpoche in 1956. That's what he used to look like. I've actually got another photograph here, which maybe I can stick somewhere. It's a bit small. Yeah, that's more what he looks like nowadays. There, except that now his hair has gone completely white. Huh? The other man on the right is one of Rinpoche's top disciples, an old Nyingmapa Lama called Ampa Lama. And I'll say a bit more about him, because it was him who took me to meet Chatrau Rinpoche, and it was through Ampa Lama that I managed to get quite a bit of time with Rinpoche. So, Chatrau Sangye Dorje Rinpoche. Tonight I'm going to give my talk in 3 sections. The first section is going to be a bit of a thumbnail sketch of Rinpoche's life, give you an idea of what he did, where he comes from, and so on. The second section, I'll be looking at Bhante and his connection with Chatrau Rinpoche. And then in the third section, I'd like to tell you a little bit about one or two of the encounters that I've had with Chatrau Rinpoche. One of the things that you can't have failed to notice over the course of the last 6 weeks or so is that Bhante's teachers are all quite extraordinary men, very, very gifted men, quite extreme in many cases, even quite eccentric. And I think that even amongst gifted, extreme and eccentric men, this one stands out. Yeah? So, Chatrau Rinpoche. He was born in eastern Tibet. He was born in 1913, which I think makes him about 84 years old, thereabouts. And he was born into a nomadic tribe in Kham. His tribe was called the Abse tribe. And there's not an awful lot known about him. I presume they were probably nomadic shepherds of some kind, because just about everybody in eastern Tibet is. And they migrated from Kham to Amdo. And it seems that at a very early age, at the age of 15, Chatrau, although he wasn't called Chatrau then, left his family, cut his ties with them, and went off in search of spiritual teachers. And he found some very accomplished yogis, and he took up the practice of meditation under these teachers. His first teacher, please excuse my Tibetan pronunciation, Tibetan language is very difficult. His first teacher was a woman called Serakandro Dewey Dorje. Say more about her later on. And then he had another very important teacher called Tulke Dorje Drado. Doesn't mean much. And then his most important teacher was somebody called Kathok Kenpo Nguawang Paozang Rinpoche. All of these were, of course, very accomplished meditation teachers. Rinpoche took up various meditation practices under these teachers and Dharma study. He seemed to excel and became very quickly in his own right a renowned meditator. He seems to, even at the early age, been quite extreme. He, although he was wandering in eastern Tibet, which is basically a vast high-altitude desert, he stopped using a horse, and he just walked everywhere, which is quite something, if you know what eastern Tibet's like. He refused even to use a horse. And he refused to enter into a house or even a tent of a household person. He preferred just to live in caves or in hermitages or in his own little tent that he carried with him. He was quite... he'd quite definitely cut his ties with the worldly life, and he wanted absolutely nothing to do with it. Later on, he came to central Tibet, and he became a disciple of Dujum Rinpoche, who we've already heard about. Dujum Rinpoche, the great Nyingma teacher. And he became one of Dujum Rinpoche's top disciples. He also met around this time Jamyang Kensi Choki Lodro, another one of Banti's teachers, the great Sakyapa. And these three men, well, they became friends, and they also became teachers to each other. Because not only was he a disciple of Jamyang Kensi and Dujum Rinpoche, he also gave certain meditation practices to them, and they taught each other. And actually, these three men became very important in Tibetan Buddhism, because they became the three most important figures in the Rime movement. I don't know if any of you have heard of the Rime movement. This is a movement that was started in the last century in Tibet, because the different schools within Tibetan Buddhism, they became increasingly sectarian and actually quite antagonistic to each other. This was obviously not such a good thing, because they could all learn from each other. And these three men became the leading figures this century in this ecumenical movement to bring the schools together, to share the teachings that they had. And they became a kind of triad, and they had many disciples in common. Around about this time, Rinpoche came to Lhasa, and he must have been, I would imagine, in his 20s by this time. And already a reputation of a great Dharma knowledge and a great yogi. And he started to attract quite a following in Lhasa, amongst the nobility of Lhasa, and everybody really. His reputation as a teacher was already quite established. Many, many people used to come to him for teachings, to give initiations, and in this way he started to get a bit kind of... He didn't like this very much, because really, in his heart, he was a yogi. He really loved the practice of meditation. And he realized that all this attention, all these disciples, were not what he wanted. He saw them as an obstacle to his own practice of meditation. So the story goes that even the regent of Tibet had become a disciple of Chatra Rinpoche. And what he did at one point was he was giving a special meditation practice to the regent of Tibet. And part of this ritual was to make offerings to the Rinpoche. And in the case of the regent, these offerings were made of gold, very valuable. And at the end of the initiation, he made these ritual offerings to Chatra Rinpoche. And Rinpoche apparently took a cloth, and he collected all the offerings and put them in a cloth, tied them up, and he gave them back to the regent and said, "Here, look after these for me, will you?" And the next day, he just walked out of Lhasa. He disappeared. And apparently, he went into seclusion. He went in and lived in caves, meditating for several decades. That's what the book says. We don't know exactly how long, but I guess it was in excess of 20 years. He went and lived in caves that Padmasambhava had lived in and meditated in, and he got on with his own meditation practice. And it was around this time that he was given the name Chatral. Chatral means unattached or unconcerned. It means unconcerned about worldly things. You can imagine, if you live in a cave and just practice meditation day and night, you're pretty unconcerned. it also has connotations of unconnected and free. So he became Chatral Sangye Dorje Rinpoche. And I think it's worth just thinking about that a little bit, imagine living in caves for more than 20 years. What that would be like for us, for me, I must say, I just cannot imagine it. I find it difficult enough to do the mindfulness of breathing and the metta-bhavana every day. Never mind be in a cave meditating basically continuously for 20 years, more than 20 years. Anyway, that's Chatral Rinpoche in his 30s, probably in his 30s and 40s. Then just prior to the invasion of Tibet, he left Tibet and he came down into Bhutan. And from Bhutan, he moved to live in India. And by this time, he had sort of come out of seclusion and was a wandering teacher. And he just used to wander wherever he felt like. He carried no possessions. He presumably, if he found a nice cave, he would meditate. If he was passing through a village, he would teach people, give initiations, give advice. But he never told anybody where he was going. And when he arrived, he never said how long he was going to stay. And he never said when he was going to leave. He's completely unpredictable. And this was Chatral Rinpoche's lifestyle. And he continued with this lifestyle for a very long period of time, actually, wandering back and forward across the Himalayas through Nepal, India, Sikkim, Bhutan. And it was at the beginning of this period in 1956 that Bhante first met Chatral Rinpoche. His name Chatral was also given to him because he was completely unconcerned with hierarchy or formal monasticism. He had no interest whatsoever. In fact, he seems to almost have avoided any kind of formal monasticism. He's kind of associated with the Nyingmapa tradition, but he's not actually a Nyingmapa. In fact, I don't think he's even ordained. It's quite interesting. Yet, he's regarded as one of the greatest Dharma and meditation teachers of this century, particularly by the Nyingmapas. So, quite an unusual character. And this was how he lived for a number of years. He set up retreat centres, and he started in later life to take on more responsibility as a teacher, but never in a formal sense. He would have certain monasteries that he would wander from, and he would stop and give teachings to the monks, the nuns, and the lay people in that vicinity. When he was in his late 50s, early 60s, he got married. Well, he didn't actually get married, but he got a wife. Sort of. A bit like his ordination. His wife was the daughter of a Terton, so she was also quite an unusual person, a practitioner in her own right. And then, when Chatral Rinpoche was in his 60s, he had two daughters. His first daughter, Sarasvati, was a tulku, apparently, of his first teacher. So a reincarnation of Sera Khandro Dewi Dorje. This was Sarasvati. I don't know if she is actually a tulku. She makes a very nice cup of tea. I'll tell you that. And his youngest daughter is called Tarashri. And they're both very different. Tarashri nowadays looks after Rinpoche's affairs. If you go to meet Rinpoche, you will come across Tarashri. And Tarashri is formidable. I think in temperament, she's much more like Rinpoche than his first daughter. And she's quite haughty, she's quite formidable. She's very young, but very rude. So be warned, Tarashri. And basically, Rinpoche now still lives the same kind of lifestyle that he always has lived. He wanders, he teaches, he doesn't tell anybody where he's going, but he now wanders with his wife, inverted commas, and two daughters. And he's still living like that, amazing, in his 80s. His legs are not quite as good as they used to be, so he doesn't walk everywhere. He's got a very nice collection of Japanese four-wheel drive Jeeps. And when he goes into his more remote retreat centres, he goes by helicopter. But still, you don't know where he is. He's quite difficult to find, I can assure you. Anyway, that is Chatrao Sangye Dorje Rinpoche. He was the first Tibetan Lama to start teaching serious meditation outside of Tibet after the invasion. He set up his first Drupdra, which is a small meditation retreat centre near Darjeeling. And he now has got several of these. He was actually the first to. A Drupdra is where you do long periods of meditation. The minimum period of time you would meditate in one of these retreat centres would be 1 year. So it's more common to do 3 years or 4 years or longer. And Rinpoche's main meditation practice, although he has done many, many meditation practices, is the practice of Dzogchen. Now, Dzogchen is a very sort of esoteric and advanced practice common to the Nyingmapas. And Chatrao Rinpoche is one of the great living masters of Dzogchen. Anyway, where was I? Yes. Bhante's connection with Chatrao Sangye Dorje Rinpoche. For quite a number of years, Bhante was thinking that he should have more connection with the Tibetan tradition. And he thought he should take tantric initiation from a Tibetan teacher, from a guru. But he hadn't been able to find anybody who he had confidence in that would be able to give him really that kind of relationship, that kind of connection. And in 1956, he was in Kalimpong when a friend of his turned up, a Sikkimese friend of his turned up. And there's a lovely description of this in Bhante's last volume of memoirs, in the Sign of the Golden Wheel. And this Sikkimese man, Sonam Topge, turned up and he went to see Bhante. He said, "There's a great, very, very famous lama has arrived in Kalimpong, and I've come to see him." Sonam was a great follower of the Nyingmapa tradition, and he was urging Bhante, saying, "You must come and see this man. He's an extraordinary man, a very great yogi, very important, and he may be able to give you initiation." And he started to tell Bhante more about Chatrao Rinpoche. Chatrao, by this time, his reputation went before him. He was a great yogi, a great meditator, a very good Dharma teacher, but he was also believed to have psychic powers and be a magician. Also, he was famous for eccentric behavior and eccentric utterances. So Bhante's curiosity was aroused by this, and he decided, yes, he would go to see this famous teacher, Chatrao Rinpoche. So he went to see Rinpoche. And it's quite interesting, he went in, met the Rinpoche, and he says that he got a shock. He really got a shock when he saw Chatrao Rinpoche, when he saw his face. And I think you can see why, actually, when you look at him. He's not an oil painting. Bhante said he had a very unprepossessing appearance. In fact, he was ugly. This is how he described him. He said he had very coarse features, quite brutal. And Bhante said he looked more like a muleteer or perhaps a cutthroat than a famous Rinpoche. However, Bhante got over this initial shock and started to converse with the Rinpoche. And as they spoke, his confidence in Chatrao Rinpoche increased considerably. The Rinpoche started to ask him questions about himself, about his practice, about the Vinaya, and so on. This is quite a sort of normal procedure amongst Tibetan teachers, to find out where you're at, if you're inhabiting the same kind of universe. And as the conversation continued, Bhante started to ask Rinpoche more questions. He said that the overall impression, you look at the man and it was quite kind of off-putting. He was dressed in apparently just a rough maroon cloak lined with grubby sheepskin. But the impression coming off the man was one of tremendous reliability, tremendous strength and depth. And more and more, Bhante had decided that he had a lot of confidence in this man as a teacher, as a serious Dharma practitioner. In fact, he started to realize that this man had something of that other dimension that he'd been looking for so long. And because of that, he asked Chadro Rinpoche, you know, what would be his tutelary deity? And Rinpoche thought for a minute or two. He said, Green Tara would be your deity. And then he gave him the practice of Green Tara. He gave him the initiation into the Green Tara practice and spent quite a long time in detailed description of how to do the practice. Apparently that first meeting that Bhante had with Chitra Rinpoche lasted for about 4 hours, and he said that when he left the Rinpoche, his mood was one of considerable elation. Bhante's not, actually I don't know how many of you have met Bhante, but he's not very easily swayed. When he says that his mood was one of considerable elation, you can imagine that there was quite a powerful character who could have that effect on Bhante. So Bhante had found his first tantric guru. A few days later, Chitra Rinpoche came to Bhante's Vihara to see him, and they talked more about the Green Tara practice. He gave him more detailed instruction in the practice, and then they went on to talk about other things. Something apparently that was on Bhante's mind at this time was his accommodation. He was living in a small hermitage, and the lease was about to run out in a few weeks' time. And Bhante was very worried because he didn't have anywhere to live. And he told Rinpoche this. He said, I'm really concerned about where I'm going to live because the lease runs out in this. I have no money. I have no wealthy supporters. I don't know what's going to happen. What I'd really like to do is to have a large centre devoted to monastic practice here in Kalimpong. And apparently immediately Rinpoche said, don't worry, you'll have your large monastic centre very soon. And Bhante was really shocked, huh? But he said it quite categorically. He said, you'll have it within a matter of weeks. Yeah? And it should be called the Vihara where the three Yanas flourish. Yeah? So he composed a little verse, gave it to Bhante, written. He said, this is what you should call your Vihara. Bhante was absolutely astonished. Huh? However, lo and behold, a few weeks later, when the lease ran out on his old place, somebody came up with, a patron came up with some money, they found another property, large, and Bhante got his Vihara. And it was named the Triyana Vardhana Vihara, after the name that Chitra Rinpoche gave to Bhante. So this was the first sort of indication of his psychic powers? Ah, maybe not, I don't know. Anyway, he made a prediction that came true. Another prediction that he made of Bhante on another occasion was, he said, you will start a Buddhist movement, yeah? And it will be very large and very successful. Yeah? Interesting, eh? So perhaps by now we're beginning to get a little bit of a picture about what this man is like, this man Chitra Rinpoche. Somebody who's quite disconnected really with formal Buddhism, but with a tremendous knowledge of Buddhism, understanding of Buddhism, and a tremendous embodiment of the ideals of Buddhism. Great yogi. Bhante says that there was definitely something about Chitra Rinpoche. There was a depth to the man that was difficult to fathom. I'd like to move on now to tell you a little bit about some of my own encounters with Chitra Rinpoche and a few impressions that I got myself. And I hope in this way I can sort of begin to flesh them out a little bit more for you. In 1992-93, I was living in Kathmandu in Nepal, teaching the Dharma and teaching meditation. And I'd heard that sometimes it was possible to meet Chitra Sangye Dorje Rinpoche at a little monastery underneath Swayambhunath Stupa. So it was in my mind, I thought, I must try and meet that man. I must say, personally, I was very fascinated by the figure of Chitra Rinpoche. I'd heard about him through various people. And I think of all Bhante's teachers, he was the one that appealed to me most of all. I think because he was so unconventional and kind of wild. You know? Anyway, I think it was March 1993. I woke up one morning before dawn. Yeah? I woke up and I thought, I felt very strange. I thought, today is going to be an interesting and unusual day. I thought, I think I'll go and try and find Chatro Sangye Dorje Rinpoche. So I went out onto my bike, pre-dawn, cycling up to Swambanath Stupa. And it's quite magical. How many of you here have been to Kathmandu? Probably a few, eh? Quite magical in the morning in Kathmandu around dawn. It's lovely. Cycling up to Swayambhunath Stupa, looking for Chatral Sangye Dorje Rinpoche. I went to the little Gompa that I had been told about. And sitting outside the Gompa was this man here, Umpa Lama. Huh? Now, Umpa Lama, he doesn't speak any English. Huh? In fact, his Nepalese is quite ropey as well. Huh? So is mine. However, I met Umpa Lama, and I just thought, well, I've got to ask him. I didn't know. I went up and said, Tashidelig, I'm looking for Chatro Sangye Dorje Rinpoche. I sort of, I said, Chatro Sangye Dorje Rinpoche. I kept repeating this name, and he's going, and he finally called somebody over, a Tibetan man who could speak English, and he translated for me. And I was explaining to Umpa Lama that I was trying to find Chatro Sangye Dorje, and I really wanted to find him. He said, okay, come back in 3/4 hour once I've had my breakfast. I did, and I got to know this man a little bit better. He's a very, very lovely old Nyingmapa monk, very friendly, quite strong in himself. And I was quite frightened of him at first, I must say, because he also seemed to have this Tibetan habit. A lot of Nyingmapa monks are a little bit unhinged, eh? And they do, it's true actually, they do eccentric things, like, you know, they ring bells and sprinkle you with water, and they do, you know, what's he doing, you know? He was doing all this kind of thing. Anyway, to cut a long story short, a taxi had turned up outside his little Gompa, and he gave me a kata, and he said, come on. And we got into this taxi, and off we went. So I didn't know what was happening, but I realised after a few minutes, I think he's taking me to meet Chatro Rinpoche. And off we went in this taxi, the way out through Kathmandu, way out through Patan, into the countryside, around about beautiful up into the hills. And we went to a place called Godowari, which is about 30 kilometres to the south of Kathmandu. It's in a lovely valley with very steep hills covered in trees. And we stopped near a spring. There's a spring coming out of the hillside with a pool underneath it. And just behind the spring there's a number of trees and many, many hundreds of lines of Tibetan prayer flags, yeah? Which always means that there's a cave there. This is a cave where some important yogi, probably in this case Padmasambhava, has lived and practiced there. And we got out of the taxi and entered into a compound that butted onto this wood right beside the cave. And as we entered, I noticed that it was a slightly sloping field. At the top of the field, a little gompa, and many, many Tibetan people around. They seemed to be erecting some big marquee. And in the middle of the field, there was a octagonal-shaped sunshade, very large, almost as big as this room. And off to one side, a rough open-air kitchen. Many, many Tibetan people, many monks, nuns, and lay people. And there was a ghetto blaster, yeah, playing Tibetan country and western. At least that's what it sounded like. And we arrived in this place, eh? And Umpa Lama, he has great difficulty walking. He's stooped over, eh? He's very old actually. And he arrived, and all the young monks came running towards him. Oh, hello. Boom, banging heads together. This is what they do, eh? When Tibetans come together, they bang heads, eh? Boom, like that. It's a sort of sign of affection and friendship. Everybody knew Umpa Lama. He's a very, very popular man, eh? We were seated down underneath this sunshade. And there was a carpet underneath it, large carpet. As I say, it was about the size of this room. And at the top end, there was a raised dais, just a simple a sort of platform, really covered in carpets, yeah? With a meditation cushion on it. And we sat down, and the young monk came with a huge bowl like this, full of coconut pieces and bits of chocolate and biscuits and things. So snacks, tea, Tibetan tea, great. And there we were sitting in Godowari, and many lay people behind where the country and western was coming from, chopping vegetables, cooking. Very, very nice atmosphere, very beautiful place. And at a certain point, I think we must have sat there for about 45 minutes or something, when you heard a car door close, boom, and immediately the country and Western music went off, huh? And some people entered into the compound, and there was a little line of stupas, huh? And there was somebody walking behind the stupas, and suddenly this man came into view, huh? And immediately, God, you could not mistake who this was, huh? He's walking very fast, not very large man, a little bit taller than me, very powerfully built, huh? And of course it was Chatral Rinpoche, huh? I must say, I've never seen so much effect on a situation by one man, ever. It was almost as if Padmasambhava himself had walked into the enclosure, huh? Walking around the stupas, suddenly everybody, huh, was prostrating in his direction, huh? You sort of imagine this, either kowtow down or the full prostration on the ground, yeah? Especially the monks moving towards him and prostrating in his direction, offering katas. Ampa Lama himself, who has great difficulty moving, he was up and over, walking towards Rinpoche with a kata across his hands like this, which he offered to Rinpoche. Rinpoche took it round his neck, tapped on the head, walked up, sat down on his dais, yeah? Moving very fast, eh? And I must say, I was absolutely fascinated. I was watching this man. Ah, this is the man I had come to see. And he was with an entourage of monks. There was maybe about 10 or 12 young monks with him. And they all sat in the line opposite Ampa Lama and I. I went up, made a prostration, offered a kata. Rinpoche took it, tapped me on the head, back to my seat. And it's quite interesting. He arrived with a tremendous amount of energy, huh? And I was absolutely fascinated by him. He's quite squat, short cropped hair like this, long white beard, red robe lined with sheepskin, huh? And he sat down on this dais like a king, huh? If you could imagine, took off his robe, there's a young attendant monk around him fixing it for him, his bum bag, his mala. Like a king, yeah. He was very regal, yeah. But very brutal face, yeah. Again, the same. He looked as if he was carved out of walnut, yeah. Very deeply lined face. And I'd never seen anybody like him, I must say. I'm fascinated by him, yeah. Tremendous amount of energy, tremendous authority, but at the same time as this brutal face, very, very refined, yeah. There's something quite unusual about him. Anyway, gradually the atmosphere calmed down a little bit. There was a young monk at the top of the line, took out a clipboard, and he started taking notes. Everything that Rinpoche said, he wrote it down. Huh? And another two quite senior lamas, Nyingmapa lamas, arrived, and we were urged down by the attendant monk. Lampa Lama and I were moved down to make room for these two two relatively senior monks. Huh? They handed him an airmail envelope. I think it was full of money, actually. And Rinpoche took the envelope, opened it, looked at the letter, little pouch. He got a stamp out, stamped it. And it was quite interesting, actually. There was a certain kind. He had a tremendous presence. Chatral Rinpoche had an amazing presence. You could feel it from 50 yards. Huh? Very energetic, but very calm. Huh? And there was a sensation of an immense amount of space. Yeah? I don't know if I can quite do it justice, but very spacious feeling, very deep and calm, yeah? And almost timeless. Yeah? So this sort of very interesting atmosphere was beginning to be built up, even in the space of a few minutes. And it was emanating from Chatral Rinpoche himself. Yeah? I was absolutely fascinated. I was watching him like a hawk, actually. You know, and I felt very privileged, because here I was, the whole situation is completely Tibetan, I was the only Westerner there. Very, very beautiful place. And I thought, this is just like a dream, you know, it's quite amazing. The two Rinpoche, the two lamas beside us, they were having a real laugh about something. And I noticed they had a large sort of card. And there was a black and white photograph of it, of what looked to me like a sort of Persian woman, huh? This is quite interesting, actually, because it wasn't quite pornographic, yeah, but it was risque, yeah. And they were in hoots of laughter, these two lamas, eh? And they handed it to Chatral Rinpoche, and they were saying something to the crowd of monks, and all the monks were killing themselves laughing, rolling about on the ground, you know. And they handed this card to Chatral Rinpoche, and it was very interesting to see his response, eh? Because he took this card, he read what was on the back, it was obviously to him from somebody, and he read it, he turned it over, and he looked at the picture. He showed neither elation or amusement or disapproval. Eh? He was just like completely unaffected. The whole bunch of monks are rolling about laughing. And he just sort of went, he put it down and started talking about something else. Eh? It was very interesting, actually. He was not going to take any cues from the people around him. He was his own reference, if you can see what I mean. Eh? He wasn't affected by that at all. Eh? So I thought that was quite interesting in itself. And at this point, I showed to Ampalama a photograph that I had. I had a photograph of Bhante and I in Gukyaloka together. And he said, oh, you go and show it to Rinpoche, you know. So I went up, I showed the photograph to Rinpoche. And through the monk who was taking notes, he said, ah, Sangharakshita. He said, how is Sangharakshita? And I said, oh, very well. This was taken in Spain, a retreat centre several years ago. And I was telling him about it and talking to Rinpoche, the monk translating for me. And after a few minutes I felt a tug at my back, and this was the attendant monk pulling me away. He's always got an attendant monk nearby to, if people are pestering, they get pulled back. So I was pulled back to my seat. Anyway, a couple of minutes later Rinpoche asked me, he said, again through the senior monk, he said, have you got any specific questions for me? He was obviously interested that I was there and paying attention to me. And I had to say, no, I don't have any specific questions. I've just come to pay my respects to one of my teacher's teachers. And he seemed quite happy about that, actually. The atmosphere continued to become more calm, more clear, and peaceful, spacious. A very joyous atmosphere, actually. A beautiful lunch was brought up, served to us by monks, and it was vegetarian. And that's quite interesting as well in Tibetan circles. Not many Tibetans are completely vegetarian. This was completely vegetarian, and that was interesting as well. And we had this meal. Rinpoche talking now and again, looking at the monks, asking questions. He's obviously got quite a sense of humour, because quite a lot of the things he was saying, people were really finding very funny. Huh? He's very witty, very deep voice. And yeah, I was just fascinated by him. I sort of watching him and just drinking in the scene. And at a certain point, I noticed that Rinpoche had picked up his mala, his beads, and started to till his beads. He closed his eyes. He was meditating, I think, actually. Immediately, I started meditating as well. I closed my eyes, started meditating. Just getting a feeling for what was happening, yeah? And something quite extraordinary sort of happened to me. I was sitting there in meditation, instantly very, very concentrated, very, very calm. But the calmness seemed to start expanding and becoming deeper, huh? In quite a tangible sort of way. Huh? So I sat there for, I don't know how long, 2-3 minutes, and then opened my eyes. Rinpoche sort of put his beads aside. And there was a really magical moment for a few minutes. This incredibly peace, silence, yeah? Just this warm breeze, some birds flying about, prayer flags flying. And I thought, wow, this is incredible. A couple of thoughts went through my mind when I stopped meditating. I thought, this is something very significant. Yeah? I thought, well, I had a feeling that I had wanted to reconnect with this man, and I had reconnected with him. Nothing very obvious was taking place, but at the same time I had a very deep sensation that this is perhaps one of the most significant moments of my life. Very interesting. I don't know if I can quite sort of communicate to you what was going on. There was a sort of magical atmosphere. Anyway, I had a talk to give that afternoon in Kathmandu. Time was moving on. And I realised that I was going to have to leave. I didn't want to, I must say. I felt incredibly happy and very fortunate to be there. My feeling was I would like to just stay with this man for the rest of my life. That was how I felt. However, I did have to go. I had a talk with those posters all over Kathmandu. So I said to Ampalama, look, I'm going to have to go now. See you later. And I got up, went to Rinpoche to make a prostration to leave, and he stopped me. No, come back here. And so I came round, sat at his side, and he picked up this kata again that I had given him. I didn't really know what to do, but I sort of knelt down beside him, bowed. He put the kata around my neck, tug, blessing, like that. Very interesting. I remember I came up from that little bow and I was sort of very close to him like that, looking into his face, and he's got quite a powerful face actually. And I was sort of looking at him and I felt ecstatically happy. I was sort of, I think it was probably a smile from ear to ear, yeah? And he was just looking at me like that, very strong look, gaze. And eventually he just gave a little hint of a smile. I got up and left. Bye. And off I went. I had to go and get the taxi. And I left that meeting in a mood of considerable elation. To put it mildly. I was very, very energised. And I can't really go into details. I don't have time. But for about 2 weeks after that meeting, I was just so brimming full of energy that I could hardly contain it. I started to affect other people. Not just me, other people around me started shaking. All sorts of strange things, eh? And that was the first time I met Chatral Rinpoche. I found that quite often, if I meditated or slept at night, his face would come into that, particularly that face just when we were very close together. I could not get rid of the image of his face from my mind. And I think for probably upwards of 2 years after that meeting, he would come into my thoughts all the time, nearly every day, I think. So the meeting, although not much had actually happened, quite a lot had actually happened in a certain sense. So this is Chatral Sangye Dorje Rinpoche. He's got a very otherworldly quality about him. It's kind of hard to describe, actually. He's there with a very, very strong tangible presence, but you get a sense of a man who there's much more to than that. I don't know whether he's got psychic powers or not, but judging on the effect he's had on me, he's certainly the most potent man that I've ever met. He's very unpredictable. I don't think he's a very easy person to have as your teacher. How are we doing for time? Oh, bad. Several other order members have met Chatral Rinpoche. Sometimes the meetings go very well, sometimes they don't go very well at all. Even with his own disciples, the meetings don't necessarily go very well. One of the more successful meetings was between Paramartha, an order member called Paramartha, and Chatral Rinpoche. This took place in Siliguri, where he has a monastery. And Paramartha had managed to find the Rinpoche, and he was waiting in a little reception room to meet him. And there was an American disciple of Chatral Rinpoche with him. And this disciple was a personal disciple of Chatral Rinpoche. He'd received meditation practices from him. He hadn't seen him for 7 years, but he finally managed to save up the money, get free from his responsibilities in New York, come all the way to Nepal to see his teacher again to get some teachings. He's very sort of excited. And Paramartha was very nervous. He'd never met the man. He'd heard so much about him. The American disciple was called in. 2 minutes later, he came down the stairs again with his face. Absolutely. He got 2 minutes after 7 years. Paramartha thought, oh God, he got 2 minutes, what am I going to get? Anyway, Paramartha went in and he got 2 hours. And not only that, he got a meditation practice. He got a special form of the Padmasambhava practice. And he got on great with Rinpoche. So he's very unpredictable. I get the sense that his unpredictability is slightly predictable, actually. If you're trying to manipulate him or get something out of him, you won't. know. And you can see this in the kind of respect that his personal disciples have for him. In fact, they're terrifying of him, especially the monks and the nuns. It's quite amazing. So this is Chitral Rinpoche. I think that he is probably a very good man for Bhante's first connection with a tantric guru, because he had this depth to him, this, you know, decades of meditation practice behind him. He is very much a yogi in the Tibetan tradition. It's impossible to overestimate the amount of respect the Tibetan people show for Chitral Rinpoche. It is really as if Padmasambhava himself was present. It's quite interesting. There's another written account of a famous American monk, Thomas Merton, the Trappist monk. He went on a world tour. And on his world tour, he'd gone freelance. He'd gone looking for great spiritual teachers. And this was in the late 60s, and he was travelling around the world. He was in India. He was meeting all the most famous teachers he could find. And finally, he was taken to meet Chitral Rinpoche. And it seems like they got on very, very well indeed. And at a certain point, he asked Rinpoche about what kind of meditation practices he was doing. And Rinpoche said, well, Dzogchen really is his main thing, you know. And Thomas Merton said, well, I would like to take up that meditation practice with you as my teacher. And Rinpoche said, okay, fine. We can arrange for you to do the 1 year preliminary solitary retreat in Sikkim, no problem, we can set it all up for you. He said, well, fine, I'll do that. He said, but I want to continue with my world tour, and then I'll come and take up that practice with you. Now, that was a great shame, I think, for two reasons. Thomas Merton unfortunately died shortly after that. He got electrocuted in a shower. However, when he left Chitral Rinpoche, he turned to the man that was with him, and he said, that is the greatest man I have ever met. He's my teacher. So this is quite something. A man who was quite a spiritual teacher in his own right was travelling around meeting all the greatest teachers he could, and out of all these teachers, Chitral Rinpoche had made the biggest impression on him. There was a little bit of sort of banter between them, it seems. Thomas Merton asked Rinpoche if he was enlightened, and Rinpoche said, no, he said, I'm not enlightened. He said, I've meditated, he said, I've done more than 30 years of solitary meditation. He said, I'm not enlightened. He said, but I tell you what, he said, if you take up the Dzogchen practice, let's practice Dzogchen and see who gets enlightened first, eh? there's a nice kind of light banter between them, eh? He is certainly the greatest man I've ever met, eh? I'll finish just with a couple of little things. When Paramartha met Rinpoche, he was asking him a number of questions. He had gone prepared. He had questions for the Rinpoche. One of the questions he asked Rinpoche, he said, you're called Chitral, which means unconcerned or unattached. And you certainly seem to have that unattached quality. He said, how do you get that? And Chitral Rinpoche apparently turned to him, he had a very big smile, and he said, Dzogchen! Great. He asked him another question. He said, Rinpoche, how can I be sure that my Dharma practice is effective? And Rinpoche immediately gave him a very straightforward answer. He said, if you want to be sure that your Dharma practice is effective, do it for other people. And I thought that was quite something, actually. He said, so simple, yet so profound. If you want it to know that your Dharma practice, your meditation practice is effective, do it for other people. Anyway, I hope I've been able to communicate to you something of what this man is like. And he is, as I've said, certainly the greatest man I've ever met. I feel very grateful for having met him. And that is the penultimate talk. That is another one of Sangharakshita's extraordinary teachers. So I'm just very glad to be able to tell you a little bit about my meetings and impressions of Chitral Sangye Dorje Rinpoche. Mm-hmm.